By downloading or listening to this podcast, you are agreeing to Moody's legal terms and conditions found at moodys.com/disclaimer, including that the information provided is not investment or financial advice, and that Moody's will not be liable for losses arising from your use of the information.
I'm Danielle Reed, and this is Moody's Talks, Focus on Finance. In today's episode from Moody's offices in New York, I'll be speaking to insurance team analyst Kelvin Kwok, who is in Hong Kong, SAR, about what life insurers in the Asia-Pacific region are doing in terms of their investments and also their asset liability management to adjust to a higher interest rate environment. Later from London, my co-host Miles Nelligan will talk to banking team analysts Matthias Frithjof in Stockholm and Farouk Khan in London about how rising rates are affecting Western European banks broadly and banks and building societies in the UK specifically. Miles, hi. There have been some events over in UK markets recently.
That's no exaggeration, Danielle. It's been a turbulent few weeks. The main impact for banks and their customers, however, has been a rise in bond yields and therefore also in mortgage rates.
So what are the highlights from your conversation with Farouk and Matthias? What kinds of effects are banks in Western Europe and in the UK in particular experiencing from higher interest rates?
Well, over the next year or so, banks in Western Europe and also banks and building societies in the UK will benefit from higher net interest margins thanks to rising rates. That's because they'll be able to lend at higher rates than they pay depositors.
Right. There's that lag before deposits start to increase. And one thing to clarify, building societies in the UK are like cooperative or mutual banks, right? Meaning they're owned and run by the people who use them.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
Okay. And so getting to what you were going to say about the long-term effects of higher interest rates for banks in the region, what are those?
Well, in the longer term, a combination of high inflation, high energy costs, particularly as the Ukraine conflict persists, and of course also weaker growth will ultimately lead to higher loan losses. Now, in the UK, the recent rise in bond yields will feed through, and in fact has already fed through, to much higher mortgage rates, which will add to the problem there. But it's important to say that banks in the UK and elsewhere do, of course, have substantial reserves and capital buffers, which will help them weather the stress.
Right. So in some sense, there's a short-term gain, but long-term pain, or at least some increase in pain. Miles, I'm looking forward to your conversation with Farouk and Matthias in just a few minutes. But first, I'm here with insurance team analyst Kelvin Kwok, based in Hong Kong, SAR, to talk about what life insurers in Asia Pacific are doing to adjust to a higher interest rate environment. Kelvin, welcome.
Hi, Daniel.
So, Kelvin, a report you just published is based on a survey you did that got responses from 16 life insurance companies in Asia Pacific. So that's 3 based in Hong Kong, 7 in Japan, 4 in Korea, and 2 in Taiwan. And the survey was about how they're changing their investment strategies and handling asset liability management now that interest rates are rising in the region.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Before I ask about the results of the survey, just a little context. Rates are rising because after the Federal Reserve in the U.S. decided to raise policy rates in the U.S. here, several central banks in the Asia-Pacific region followed suit. By raising rates, central banks in Asia-Pacific are, like the Fed, trying to contain inflation, which has risen globally with energy price shocks and supply chain shocks. And also, they're likely trying to avoid currency devaluations that might occur if suddenly it was more advantageous to move investments to the U.S. because of higher rates of return relative to the rest of the world. So with that background, why are these higher policy rates significant for life insurers in Asia Pacific?
Well, big picture, certainly there are some benefits to higher rates and also some significant risks. So starting with the benefits, first, higher rates definitely means higher recurring yield on life insurers' new bond investments. So we see it particularly beneficial to Taiwanese and Korean insurers that have large block of guaranteed liabilities, which means products they sold in the past for which they guaranteed policyholders high rate of returns. So with this higher returns on bonds, this is very helpful to reduce this insurer's negative spread risk exposure. And secondly, higher rates is indeed good for life insurers to narrow their asset liability duration mismatches, and therefore their sensitivity of net worth to interest rate changes. This work as higher rates give insurers more flexibility to invest in long-dated bonds to match the duration of their policy liabilities while meeting their investment returns target.
Right. So, I mean, after the low rates of, who knows how many years, a lot of years, a decade or so, suddenly these longer dated investments are yielding a little bit more, and that's helpful. What are the biggest risks for life insurers in the region?
I'll say hedging costs is one of the biggest. This can increase as the gap widens between domestic interest rate and rising rate in United States. And in fact, most of the insurers we survey said that because of the higher hedging costs, they actually expect investment yield on their portfolio to decline despite higher yields on new bond investments. And besides, the largest share of insurers we surveyed were also concerned about three key risks. The first one is recession risk. And the second one is interest rate risk arising from mismatch of asset liability durations. And the last one is credit risk.
Got it. And I can imagine that recession risk is really top of mind for everyone. So you've laid out the positives and negatives of the current environment. What have insurers said they plan to do to adjust? I mean, are they changing their investment mix?
Most said they will buy some more bonds to take advantage of higher yields. But they also said they are unlikely to significantly change their investment allocations. We think that's because when insurers are thinking about their asset allocations, they increasingly need to consider the features of their policy liabilities, especially when there is looming changes to their accounting rules and also to their capital regimes. So these changes would mean certain type of investment would cost them higher capital charge than before.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense if they're facing a slightly altered regulatory environment. Now, there are some differences by country in terms of whether life insurers are going to buy foreign or domestic bonds, correct?
Yeah, you are correct. Japanese insurers have lower cost of liabilities and longer liability durations than their peers in Asia, which enable them to invest in longer-term domestic government bonds while maintaining their duration matching. And they also have lower reliance on investment spread gains for earnings. So these features give them more flexibility to shift away from foreign bonds. But in Taiwan, it's a different story. Taiwanese insurers remain highly keen on purchasing long-dated foreign bonds to enhance their recurring yield and lengthen their asset durations. This is driven by their needs to cover their high cost of liabilities and their heavy reliance on spread gains for earnings. So it really does vary by countries somewhat.
Kelvin, thank you so much. And we're now joined by my co-host, Miles Nelligan, here to talk to Farooq Khan and Matthias Fritjof about the effects rising interest rates are having for UK banks and building societies, and also for Western European banks.
Thanks very much, Danielle. And thanks to Matthias and Farooq for joining us.
Hi, Miles. Nice to be here.
Great to be here, Miles.
So, Matthias and Farooq, you've recently published reports examining the impact of rising rates on banks in respectively Western Europe and the UK. To summarize, it looks as though the effect will be mostly positive for the next few months, but there will probably be loan quality issues further out because slowing growth, high inflation, and of course, higher borrowing costs will put some strain on household finances. As we'll discuss later, this is especially true in the UK, where there's been a big jump in mortgage rates. But before we get to that, Matthias, let's start with Western Europe. Could you talk us through what's been happening there?
Well, we're coming from a situation where we've had very low or even negative interest rates for a very long time. But during this time, banks' lending and deposits have remained, for the most part at least, in the positive territory. But now when interest rates are starting to increase, we see that banks are increasing the lending rates much faster than deposits. The higher lending rates, while deposit remains close to zero, will have a positive effect on net interest margins. And then also we saw in the first half of 2022 that the economy has recovered from the pandemic. We also saw very high levels of loan growth.
Tell me, Matthias, have net interest margins risen at the same pace for banks across Western Europe?
Well, not really. Banks operating in countries where central banks raised interest rates earlier have had a stronger benefit. So this was mainly in the UK, for example, but also in Norway and to some extent Sweden. But within the Eurozone, of course, we saw the ECB didn't really raise the interest rate until July. So in the first half of the year, we really didn't see so much positive effect from this within the Eurozone. But the Eurozone banks also have substantial operations outside of the Eurozone. And through that, they also had some benefits. But to reap the benefits of these higher interest rates, it also depends on how quickly and to what extent banks are able to actually reprice the lending side. So this varies quite a lot between countries within Western Europe. And we could see probably the Nordic countries have the most ability to reprice quickly. That's excluding Denmark. But also we see the UK and some other European jurisdictions would have relatively shorter fixed rate lending. Then we can also see that banks, which are mainly deposit funding, had a positive effect. So that would again be the UK, for example, but also banks in Germany and Austria had relatively strong performance from this.
Thanks for that, Matthias. Farouk, turning to you, it sounds like UK lenders are among the beneficiaries so far.
Right, that's correct. You know, banks and building sites in the UK they've seen strong net interest margin growth in the first half of 2022. I mean, we've had six rate rises in the UK in 2022, and that's allowed banks and building societies to swiftly raise the rates they charge on new and variable mortgages, loans to companies, to small and mid-sized enterprises, and also on unsecured consumer loans. On the liability side, banks and building societies are largely deposit funded. About 80% of their total funding is made up of deposits, and a lot of that is made up of current accounts, which are interest-free. So banks have been able to pass on rates on the asset side, but they haven't passed on rates to depositors. And they've been slow to do that. We only do that on a staggered basis. So as a result, their net interest margins have gone up, and we expect rate rises to lift their net interest income in 2022 by 20% versus 2021. And I guess we have the Monetary Policy Committee meeting in November. And they're expected to raise rates. So this dynamic will be enforced further.
Now, it's worth explaining perhaps for non-UK listeners that UK banks and building societies are really very heavily exposed to the mortgage market, aren't they?
Yeah, that's precisely correct. You know, according to Bank of England data, mortgages are around 70% of total system lending. And building societies themselves, they're pretty much entirely focused on mortgages. Their remit is to promote wider home ownership. On top of this, what we see in the UK is that there's a large share of short-dated fixed-rate mortgages, normally between 2 and 5 years. In fact, there's only 4% of total mortgage lending that is fixed beyond the 5-year period. So effectively, as these loans keep coming due and come due in this higher rate environment, banks will be able to reprice these loans at much higher rates. And just to give an example, according to Bank of England data, a 2-year 75% loan-to-value mortgage had an average cost of around 3.6% as of August 2022, which is more than double the rate that it was at 3 years previously. Now, given all the volatility we've seen in the UK over the last few weeks, this differential is even higher now.
Okay, so possibly some additional strain on household finances in the months ahead. Matthias, back to you. Looking ahead, how long do you expect net interest margins to keep rising in Western Europe, but both within and outside the Eurozone?
Well, I mean, the obvious answer is, of course, that for as long as deposit rates remain mostly close to zero, the interest margin will continue to expand for Western European banks. For the countries where interest rate rose earlier, that will be at least through 2022 and possibly sometime as well into 2023. And then for the Eurozone banks, this will probably be throughout 2023 as well.
And if I could ask you to look into your crystal ball, what happens after that?
Well, I think if we're going to broaden the scope a little bit, I think beyond 2022, I think we will see a strong performance on the top line from net interest margin expansion throughout 2023 for all Western European banks. But the sort of to what extent this will actually translate into positive net income at the end, it also depends on a lot of other factors. So, I mean, if we see a very high level of inflation, and that would mean both higher labor costs, but also other operating expenses would rise. At some point, inflation and a weaker sort of operating environment is going to start to have negative effects on payment capacity from lenders. And this could increase then to higher provisioning levels and increased level of problem loans. And a weaker economy and higher interest rates will also lead to a lower level of credit demand. So that will also be less of a positive benefit. But I think the big picture and the key risk is really the risk of a deeper recession. And especially if we would see higher unemployment levels, that could really start translating into more non-performing loans and higher costs and lower credit demand.
Matthias, thanks for that very helpful overview. Farouk, if I could ask you to look ahead at the situation in the UK as well. We heard a moment ago that mortgages have become a lot more expensive. Given the bank's big exposure to the housing market, how do you see things panning out?
Yeah, this really gets to the crux of the issue. And essentially what we're seeing is that the headwinds are gathering strength. And, you know, these headwinds are coming from, as Matthias mentioned, from higher inflation, also higher energy prices. And now we have rising rates. And all these factors are combining to create an affordability shock, not just for UK households, but also for corporates. Now, how does this affect banks? You know, we're likely to see lower volumes of new lending as rates become less affordable. And as I mentioned previously, refinancing of mortgages are going to be at much higher rates. So this raises quite a few questions. Are mortgages going to be affordable? Are payments going to be up to date? And what are banks going to do to help borrowers? So taking all of that into consideration, you know, we expect asset risk to rise and to manifest in 2023. And, you know, what will really determine the extent of the credit deterioration will be two main factors. And as Matthias mentioned, unemployment is a key driver of delinquencies for mortgage lenders. Unemployment in the UK is at 70-year lows, 3.5%. Is it going to move from that? Wait and see. And I guess the second factor is really the extent of the payment shock and whether households and corporates can manage this through dipping into savings or cutting down on discretionary consumption.
Thanks, Farouk. And actually picking up on that sort of the macro question, I have a question for both for you and Matthias. Let's say there's a more extreme downside macroeconomic scenario. You know, what happens then? Farouk, let's start with you for the UK perspective.
Well, banks at the moment, they are shielded by both their capitalization levels and also their provisioning levels. I mean, banks have, on average, a tangible common equity to risk-weighted assets ratio of around 17.5% as of June 2022 under our calculations. On top of that, on a regulatory basis, the Bank of England conducts quite conservative stress tests on banks, as well as building societies, and see whether they have enough capitalization in place to withstand a prolonged economic downturn. And this is included in the capital buffers that banks have to hold. On the provisioning side, you know, provisioning levels are at good levels, and banks have built up sizable, what we call post-model adjustments. And these are extra provisions they build on top of what their models are showing them. They were built up during the COVID pandemic. They've been repositioned to account for economic uncertainty and volatility going forward. And we expect banks to add to these as they benefit from above the provisioning aspect of their income statement from higher net interest income. But to your question, you know, what does a more extreme downside case entail? And that's going to mean more asset quality pressures and, you know, whether banks' capital and provisioning is sufficient in that situation. You know, but I remember the phrase, proof of the pudding will be in the eating.
Okay, thanks, Farouk. And same question then for Matthias.
So I think in general, I would agree with Farouk said, and that's generally true for most Western European banks. But we also see geographical difference between various systems. And this depends on the sort of where the macroeconomic development is going. And some systems are more exposed than others. But in general, I would say the Western European banking systems are quite robust.
Got it. Matthias, Farouk, Miles, and also Kelvin, thank you all very much for your insights. And thank you to our listeners, as always, for tuning in. To read any of the reports referenced in this podcast, you can find the links in the show notes to this episode at moodys.com/podcasts. And if you're listening to this on a streaming service, please remember to like and subscribe. And please do tune in again for future episodes of Focus on Finance.
Thanks for listening to this Moody's Talks podcast. To find out more about the topics discussed, please follow the links in the show notes. You can check out other Moody's Talks podcasts by visiting moodys.com/podcasts.